Welcome to the Social Ideas Podcast, brought to you by the Cambridge Centre for Social Innovation. This series looks through the lens of those striving for a better world. I'm Pam Mungrew. In this episode of the Social Ideas Podcast, we hear from two graduates and a current student of our Masters in Social Innovation. Jerry Ong, Va Yang and Chris Hope have come together to discuss the value and the impact of relationships in the social innovation space.
So hi, my name is Va. I'm originally from the United States, but I'm currently working in Laos in the international development space. I'm starting to develop a project to look at how we empower women, focusing on increasing gender equality. Also really passionate about thinking about how businesses can be used as a vehicle for social innovation.
Hi, I'm Chris, currently based in Melbourne. So currently a research student at Cambridge. So my interest is in how do vulnerable people overcome loneliness, or how does loneliness affect vulnerable people? I am the founder of a nonprofit. We work in the mental health space. Currently writing a book with some other Cambridge students on social connection and a TEDx speaker as well. I did a project where I met 100 strangers for coffee in 100 weeks. And that kind of led me to a lot of this work and a lot of my thoughts and kind of feelings about social connection, loneliness, friendship, and some of the other things that I imagine that we will be discussing during this episode.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jerry. I graduated from the Masters of Social Innovation program at Cambridge Judge Business School. I spent the first 5 years working in the international development sector before moving into corporate philanthropy, where I'm currently working for a tech company, looking at how can we, as a company, be useful to the society.
So thank you very much, all of you, for that introduction. I think what I want to start with is to understand what has driven you individually into the social innovation space and to the development space.
I've always been very interested in social connection. Like, I could never probably articulate that before, exactly what that meant. But during 2016, after quite a bad year, I was sitting with my best friend and we talked about setting some goals. And one of the goals I set was to meet 100 strangers for coffee. And so I embarked on this project where I met one person a week. I was quite disconnected from myself and others, so that kind of motivated me. And throughout the project, I met a lot of very interesting people, many of whom were working in the social innovation or social change space. And that kind of inspired me in many ways. I did an internship in the Philippines also at UNICEF during this time. And that also kind of inspired some of that. But I think for me, really understanding that, I think the 100 Coffee Project unearthed in me a real interest in social connection. And I guess loneliness is kind of the opposite of that in many ways. So yeah, I became very interested in working in that area and really trying to use the project that I did myself and the impact that project had, including you know, public speaking and so on, in order to kind of impact other people also and work in this social innovation space.
Yeah, I kind of accidentally ended up in the social innovation and development space. So early on in my career, a very corporate career, and kind of through an interesting course of events, I ended up saying, well, I'm going to take a sabbatical year and do some volunteer work abroad. And that led me to Laos. And Laos led me into the international development space. And I think, like, for the first time in my life, I felt like, wow, I can do what I always wanted to do, which is make a career out of helping people. Because I think poverty in many ways can be very harrowing. And coming to Laos and being in a country that is working towards officially earning its title as a middle-income country and seeing really deep pockets of poverty, still having conversations like 30% of the population is stunted, things that just don't happen as often in the West, it can be really harrowing. And to have the opportunity to say, yes, I can be part of this journey and contribute to this, that was really exciting for me and why I continue to choose to stay in the development space. In terms of like how getting into the whole relationships thing, I think coming from my background as an American, coming from a very corporate culture where everything's very task oriented, it's very about the individual. And then coming to a culture that's very about relationships and who knows who and things getting done because of who knows who and the way people treating you because of your positionality in society and what you've done for them, what they've done for you, and having that really like hit you in the face in a really surprising way because it's so different from anything. The level of relationships is so different from anything I'd experienced in the US, but it's also taught me a lot to recognize its importance and the role that it plays and that it does truly play a role when we think about social innovation and how we want to create systemic change.
And for me, I spent the first 5 years in the international development space. And my experience then was that the model has been quite traditional, looking at how NGO have to fundraise from donors, the donors provide the funding, we implement programs, and the cycle continues. And if donor decides to pull out of the project, then we need to start looking at other donors to plug that gap. Otherwise, the work that we do eventually fade off, right? And the community that we work with so far, up to then, eventually that sort of fades away. Since then, I started thinking, is there a way to work with companies looking at emerging technologies? Can we have that being a force for good for the communities that we work with? So moving and pivoting into corporate philanthropy, I think I see a real opportunity to look at internally within companies and how to engage internal stakeholders to think about social issues beyond just profits, right? Working with internal stakeholders, can we develop features to help empower communities, and how can we have them at the forefront of what we do and in terms of product development? So I think within the company, I think I see real opportunity to have that conversation and to engage them actively and try to steer conversations to something that's just beyond like revenue and profits and losses. Those are important, not saying that that's not important for the survival of the company, but to have that conversation to be more inclusive in that way. So I see social innovation as important in that sense to drive these conversations within the company and also affecting that beyond that.
So I think also for me, what really surprised me is how at the forefront of society in Lao culture, like relationships are at the forefront of society in Lao culture. And yet in the development space, in the social innovation space, we talk about it sometimes. But for it to be such a sizable part of just the everyday conversation, and yet when we're talking about improving a society, it's such a small, it seemed to not be proportional. And that's something that for me is a flag that maybe we need to talk about this more.
And how would you talk about it more? How would you make this happen?
I think that's the hardest part. And I think that's why we don't talk about it more, because it's not measurable. And I feel like in particular in the development space, right, and in the policy space, we want to be able to measure and we want to be able to scale. And measuring relationships and scaling it is hard. So I think that's why we don't talk about it. Maybe we need to talk about it more so we can figure out how to measure it, how to see which way the wind is blowing, how do we get better at knowing if we're impacting relationships or not, and if by tapping into relationships, we're impacting the lives of people or not in positive ways. But I think that's actually quintessentially why we don't talk about it a lot, because it's really hard to do and it's really hard to measure.
I think that's very interesting, because I think if we look wider than just social innovation, if we look at society in general and we talk about relationships and how relationships have created social change, right? I think this is a very new thing that I think you're talking about as well, Var. I think that, you know, as Homo sapiens, even if we go back that, you know, to that sort of level, we have progressed as a species because we've been able to collaborate with each other, that we do. The relationships are at the forefront of our very existence, right? As very beings, we need relationships. And hence, you know, we know the damage that not having those relationships, including, you know, loneliness and so on, can cause, and social isolation. So I think that this is a very kind of new conversation as well, maybe like post-industrial revolution, perhaps, where, you know, some individualistic things came into our cultures and that was required to be innovative and so on. But I think that maybe we haven't kind of recalibrated some of that as well. So I think this conversation goes a lot further than just social innovation. It's also about, you know, how to have relationships affected as a society as well, and how do they affect our everyday? And as you said rightly there, Var, there's also a big difference between, you know, what we might consider an individualistic culture versus, say, a collectivist culture. You know, you were comparing the US to, say, Lao, for example. And I think that that's another really interesting thing that we kind of have lost a little bit in more individual cultures, that this idea of, yeah, progression is based on, you know, collaborating with each other. And that's how we actually collaborated and progressed as a species. So without that, we wouldn't be here now, right? So I think that this whole kind of idea of individualistic culture versus collectivism is also, it's more new, and it's more nuanced than just within social innovation.
I'm interested to understand, on whose terms are these relationships happening?
So in my context, it's both on an individual and on a community level, right? So like as an individual, I have positionality both, and I have networks, and the nature of my relationship with the different people in my networks is different, right? So I might have immediate family, I might have relatives, I might have people I work with, I might have friends of friends, and I will have different levels of intimacy, different levels of exchange with different people, and that impacts the nature of my relationship with them. So I think there's definitely this that like individual element of it, but then there's definitely like a community piece of it. And I feel like because I'm Hmong, and so I can speak to this more so like Hmong ethnicity within Lao, but then it becomes about me and my family, right? So when I make a decision, not me per se, because I'm very I'm very individualistic and American, but as you know, my friends, as they make decisions, they don't always make decisions for themselves. They make decisions for their family. They make decisions that bring honor or shame to their family and not just themselves. And I think that is kind of like the quintessential difference as well between like an individualistic culture versus a collectivist culture. But to answer your question, I think it's really happening at multiple levels. And it's really about the networks that you're in and your positionality and the exchanges that happen.
Yeah, and I guess to build onto that, we can look at the relationships with maybe three layers. I think if we think about, you know, we might have our inner layer relationships, which is, you know, as Barb discussed there, you know, which might be more intimate relationships. And we might consider romantic relationships in there as well. And from a business sense, that might be a business partner or whatever that is as well, someone who's very close to us. Then we might have our second layer of relationships, which is, you know, they're kind of for another purpose. And the third layer might be more acquaintances or people that we don't necessarily see as often. And I think that we need to have all three of those. And the pandemic certainly, you know, because we're talking about relationships, right? It would be, you know, amiss not to discuss also the impact of the pandemic on this. And I think that the pandemic had a major impact on those groups. And I think that particularly the second group, a lot of people lost that second ring of friends, people that they didn't see as often, or, you know, even in professional connections. And so it's really about thinking about, you know, as Var said, like we need these different layers. Like we don't just need, you know, close relationships, and we can apply this to a business sense as well. We also need those relationships that are more casual interactions as well, and maybe fall into that third layer of friendship also, or relationship.
And I can offer another perspective around relationship between donors as well as the NGOs that the donors want to work with. So looking from an organizational perspective, right? So when a corporate wants to work with an NGO, there is an imbalance of dynamics and power, and who benefits from this relationship? So I think emerging conversations around trust-based philanthropy is capturing attention in the sector, where there is a thinking that corporates and corporations should be trusting NGOs to deliver the work without having NGOs to do excessive reporting, for example, so that it takes away the time to do reporting and direct that kind of effort to support the communities. So that has been an emerging conversation in the sector. And again, I think we need to recognize the power dynamics between a donor and an NGO, where, again, like I mentioned before, NGOs are always actively fundraising. If they lose a potential donor, they need to start looking for other donors, and that requires a lot of work by submitting your consent notes, having multiple conversations, scoping the project, you know, securing budget and things like that. So enormous amount of work. So what I feel that, you know, sometimes even when corporate decides to work with a particular NGO, macroeconomics situation happen, donors will no longer have the money to support a particular project. So again, at the end of it, we need to recognize that who holds the resources tend to have more power in deciding whether how much to support and the scope of the project, you know, who to work with, the location of the project. So I think increasingly we need to shift away from that to just really trust NGO to deliver the work that they do. It's not easy as it sounds, but I think internally, I think we need within companies, we need to justify why are we giving X amount of money on a hands-off basis, right? Rather than saying that, okay, what are they delivering for us? What is the ROI for the company? Are we gaining a reputation in that aspect? So again, it's not an easy question, but I think we need to really recognize the power dynamics between corporations and also the partners that they work with.
We can apply that also to, you know, things like even government working with local communities, for example, or corporates working within local communities. And who are the, you know, who's the impact being measured for, first of all? Like, is it being measured for the donors or is it actually being measured for the beneficiaries? And then also, you know, like you said, Jerry, with the power dynamic as well, which is a really great point in relation to, you know, often the people who are on the ground in those communities, the community leaders, are the people best placed to do the work anyway. They might not have necessarily the resources of the corporate or the government or whoever is giving the money, but they should be the ones who are empowered to make those decisions. So I think that's also a part of this conversation that also needs to happen as well, is actually who is best placed to deliver the work. Maybe the corporates, you know, their role is just to give funding, right? And to have the hands-off approach and allow the people who are best placed on the ground and know the community well and understand, you know, the nuances, that they should be the ones delivering the actual work.
I'm very curious to try to unpick this sort of power imbalance within these relationships that you've all developed in very different ways, sort of on a personal and individual basis, Chris, through your 100 coffees and VAR with the work you're doing in Laos and Jerry, the work you're doing through corporate philanthropy. Because when I'm listening to what you're saying, that power imbalance strikes me as also having the potential to infantilize those on the receiving end of the work that you are doing. How do you then give agency through the relationships that you're creating and developing?
For me, I think on two perspectives. I think internally within companies, I need to actively educate the stakeholders, you know, what the relationship with NGOs should be and how it should look like, rather than allowing internal stakeholders to just exert demand and say, you know, we gave X amount of money and therefore we should be expecting A to Z as a request list, right? I think there's a lot of ongoing conversation that we need to have and to make philanthropy as progressive as possible. I think typically, you know, if you are working for a company that is still starting up, where philanthropy is only emerging within a company, they tend to want to look at what is the return of investment. If I would donate X amount of money, what is the reputation we're gaining? What is the PR? What is the communication? The opportunity with government stakeholders? So that tend to be the ROI and the ask from a company if you're still starting, I know, as progressive in philanthropy. But I think if you start, you know, looking at philanthropy as a model to look at how can we be useful to society and how are we enabling communities to thrive in places where we live and work, I think it takes on a different mindset. I think in terms of processes working with NGOs, we need to be really mindful about working with NGOs, from community-based organizations to the larger ones, like international organizations, making sure that we try to be respectful, try to make sure that we do the research on our end before we identify NGOs who are best placed to deliver certain pieces of work that we hope to invest in, right? Rather than say, oh, I'm going to call up for application and get hundreds of NGOs to submit a proposal, and then eventually only selecting one, and therefore in the process, you're just wasting everybody's time. So I think the burden should be on us to do our research and identify that one or a few number of NGOs who we feel that is more aligned with the work that we want to do, and then to work with them and partner with them in a comprehensive, holistic way, apart from not just from cash, but also looking at deploying our internal resources and products, whether are we able to use our employees to help support some of the work that NGOs are doing and delivering. So really a comprehensive suite of support in this way.
So I'm thinking about what Chris said about letting the people who are on the ground being in the best position to lead, and what Jerry is speaking about in terms of this model about enabling society. And I think, so I'm doing some research with another Cambridge grad. We're doing a case study on an organization here in Laos, and there's been a lot of top-down changes at this organization in an effort to build the capacity of the local team, of the Lao team, to really lead and take ownership in terms of responsibility and accountability for the organization. And I think within the study, what we're finding is that capacity, like the ability to actually create change, is a really important question to ask. So someone who is on the ground may know it the best, may have the best relationships, may have the best connections, but they may not have the knowledge or the skills to implement a project towards a specific objective, or they may not have had the exposure to the, I'm going to put this in air quotes, you know, best in class practices that someone who, I'm also going to put this in air quotes, an expert could come in and give. Someone who's been doing that kind of work for 10 years is very, very specialized in it. And I think that there's a balance here, and just kind of in this conversation without doing a very deep analysis of it, I think it's a question of speed and stickiness. You know, how quickly do you want to enable this change? Because if you want it to happen really quickly, you kind of need someone who's, air quotes, expert to come in, who's done it 1,000 times, to just come in and go through the checklist and say, okay, it's done, especially if it's like an extremely urgent issue, right? But then there becomes this question of stickiness, right? Like you can build 100 toilets in a village, but if people don't adapt the practice of using the toilets, it's not sticky. And you still have open defecations, you still have the same problem. And the way that you get stickiness, right, is that you get the buy-in and people want to change their behavior. I think my summary is that it's not just about who is closest to the issue. It's also a question of capacity, of ability to do it. And then in terms of, you know, task contingency, is it urgent? How sticky is it? And I think it's somewhere in between of the answer is contingent on the situation, right? But there needs to be a balance of people who have exposure to a broader experience and maybe greater experience in a particular field, and balancing that with people who know what's happening on the ground and the reality of what's happening on the ground.
That was Va Yang, Chris Hope, and Jerry Ong. You can find out more about our Masters in Social Innovation by following the Cambridge Centre for Social Innovation on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and YouTube.